You'll see a listing. Oh, I gotta fix this date. It's not the 10th anymore. Why isn't that showing up? Probably have to refresh this, would be my guess. Let's see what this does. There it is. October 17, assessing the contents and impact of the millenary petition. If you click on that and then click on the link here under notes, you will find the same notes that I'm going to be presenting here in class so that you can follow along. So without any further fooling around, let's just get right into things. We have in front of us lesson 153, and we're not where I wanted to be at this point because of the situation that I had last month with COVID. I was hoping to be through this information by now, but we're not. But, you know, it is what it is. Next Sunday, just to say it, next Sunday we will have a study during the 9 o'clock hour, but it will be part of the conference. So there'll be a conference study next Sunday at 9 a.m., but it will just be a conference session. We will not be having this class. But after that, end of October, we should be able to get a good run then, uninterrupted, you know, Lord willing, on these lessons so that we can, kind of hopefully build some momentum. But in lesson 153 today, what I want to talk about is assessing the contents and impact of the millenary petition. Now, just quick show of hands, how many of you have ever heard of the millenary petition? No one. So those of you that are online, no one in-house right now has heard of that. So everyone's going to learn something today, I suppose. Okay.
Have you mentioned it before?
I have mentioned it before in different teachings. I can't pinpoint exactly which ones I may have mentioned it in, but I know I have mentioned it. So, introduction. Last week, that should actually say 2 weeks ago, in lesson 152, we looked at some biographical information about King James. Our goal in doing so was to try and understand his personal history and psyche in order to ascertain why he might have agreed to sanction a new translation of the Bible in 1604. I believe this background regarding his personal life and ruling philosophy will help us understand what was motivating James's decision-making process as we move into future lessons. So that's what we talked about 2 weeks ago. So if you didn't get that lesson, I encourage you to go back and check that out, lesson 152 on James. Today in lesson 153, we want to look at the contents and impact of the millenary petition and calling the meeting at Hampton Court at which the decision to translate the King James Bible was made. So there's sort of like some events that are happening in chronological order that are in process here, okay? So I'm going to mention it again here in the next point, but Queen Elizabeth dies. It's announced that James, who's already King of Scotland, is going to now inherit or be the new King of England as well. And this is going to touch off a series of events now that is ultimately going to lead to the decision to translate the King James Bible. So let's talk in the next point then about the millenary petition. So Queen Elizabeth died on the morning of March 24th, 1603. Later the same day, James VI of Scotland was declared King James I of England. Sir Robert Cecil, Elizabeth's chief minister, had been negotiating this move behind closed doors since 1601. So obviously the Queen is aging, right? And there has to be some kind of plan in place for what's going to happen when the Queen dies. And so the chief minister of Queen Elizabeth, Robert Cecil, had been kind of through back channels discussing what was going to happen once the Queen died. The Queen dies March 24, 1601. James is announced King James I of England. So at that point now, he is going to be King of Scotland. He's already been the King of Scotland for, I forget the exact number of years, but it's at least 15 to 20 years. And now he's also going to become King of England. So look at the next point. On April 5, 1603, James left Edinburgh for London, promising to return every 3 years, a promise he did not keep, and progressed slowly southwards. All right, so imagine the geography of Great Britain. Scotland's in the north, England's in the south. He's been the King of Scotland now in Edinburgh for at least a decade and a half. Now, as he is announced that he is the King now of England, he starts to move southward towards England, okay? And he starts that journey on April 5, 1603. So look at the next point. On April 5, 1603, James left Edinburgh for Scotland, as I already said. Look at the next sentence. As James migrated southward, he was met in the way by a delegation of Puritans carrying a document called the Millenary Petition, the full and proper name of which is The humble petition of ministers of the Church of England desiring reformation of certain ceremonies and abuses of the Church. So that's the full title. It's shortened and known in history as simply the Molinari Petition, and there's a reason for that. Look at the next sentence. The petition outlined Puritan grievances against the Anglican Church, as well as their desire to reform some of its practices. So let's stop right there. The first study that I taught you in our resumed class, which was lesson 151, remember we talked about the religious and political context of the reign of Queen Elizabeth, and how she struck this middle way between the Catholics, the Puritans, and the Church of England, and she never did anything to, keep the Bible from the English people, but she didn't go far enough with the reforms that the Puritans wanted, okay? So now the Queen is dead, James is on his way down from Scotland, and this delegation of Puritans meets James on the way and presents to him this document. So do they see in this point now an opportunity to try to press their case or their cause with the new king, who they're hoping is going to be sympathetic to their grievances? All right, next point. The Molinari Petition is claimed but not proven to have had 1,000 signatures of Puritan ministers. So that's where it gets its name, right? Molinari meaning how many? 1,000, right? And so there is allegedly 1,000 signatures of Puritan ministers on this document that is presented to King James. Now, it cannot be proven or substantiated that there were, in fact, 1,000 signatures on the document, but it is still known to history nonetheless as the Molinari Petition. And it is a real document, as you'll see on a page coming up, that was presented to the king. Just not sure if there were actually a thousand signatures on it, okay? This carefully worded document expressed Puritan distaste regarding the state of the Anglican Church and took into consideration James's religious views as well as his liking for a debate as written in Baskill Adorn. Now, we talked about that book 2 weeks ago, a book James wrote justifying his political beliefs about divine right of kings and other things. So, these Puritans, they're not dumb. They studied James, they've read his book, they know kind of how James thinks, and so they see an opportunity here now to present the new king with their issues, or their grievances against the Anglican Church. Baskill and Adorn is separated into three books, serving as general guidelines to, if we need to look at that part of that sentence, general guidelines to follow to be an efficient monarch. The first describes a king's duty towards God as a Christian. The second focuses on the roles and responsibilities in office. And the third concerns proper behavior and daily lifestyle. The work represents James's argument for the divine right of kings as set out in the True Law of Free Monarchies, which was also written by James. It too warns against papists and derides Puritans. It advocates removing the Apocrypha from the Bible. The king's criticisms of both Catholics and Puritans is in keeping with the king's philosophy of following, quote, a middle path, a notion that would later manifest itself in James's decision to authorize a new translation of the Bible into English. So here's what you have to get. These Puritans don't know this yet, but is James very sort of favorable to the same policy as Elizabeth of kind of try to strike this middle way? So this Molinari Petition is an attempt on the part of these Puritans to, number one, understand what they can about James from reading his books. Number two, understand what they don't like about the Anglican Church and where they think these reforms have not gone far enough. And now thirdly, then, to take all that and present to the king a argument or a request that further reform be looked at. Go to page 2. Timothy Berg, author of the blog King James Bible History, does an excellent job tracing down access to the original text of the petition in his post titled The Text of the Molinari Petition. In addition to providing links to the full text of the petition in academic books from the 19th and 20th century, Berg provides an original image of the first page of the petition as it originally appeared in 1603. So when you look at this image here, This is the title page of how the image looked when it was published. Okay, so these Puritans present it to the king on his way down, and then eventually it's put to print in 1603, and this is what it looked like. All right, the humble petition of the ministers of the Church of England desiring reformation of certain ceremonies and abuses of the church. And then you can see here it's addressed to the king, to the most, I love how they just, you know, kiss his hiney here, to the most Christian and excellent prince, our gracious and dread sovereign James, by the grace of God, we, the ministers of the Church of England that desire reformation with a long, prosperous and happy reign over us in this life and in the next, everlasting salvation, right? So this now is going to be the contents of their grievances, and it's published in this document, simply known to history as the Millenary Petition, the full name, again, the humble petition of the ministers of the Church of England, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One thing you'll notice about titles in early 17th century Britain is that they certainly were not short, okay? So you can see there the image. Let's go to page 3. Interested parties can access the full text of the petition at one of the following links. So when these notes go live on the internet, those will be active links to different resources where you could call up the whole text of this thing and read it for yourself, which I know you're all going to do after church, because it'd just be so thoroughly edifying to you to read this in early 17th century English. Right, Blake?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. That's what I thought. Okay. So, any questions so far? I'm sure it will put you to sleep if you're looking for something to read before bed tonight. I have read it, and for, you know, it's, yeah, we'll just move on. Through the Millenary Petition, the Puritans sought to use their knowledge of James's writings. So again, have they read James's books? Most specifically, the True Laws of Free Monarchies and Vascal Adorn, okay? Through the Millenary Petition, the Puritans sought to use their knowledge of James's writings to petition the king for further reforms to the Anglican Church, of which James was now the head. So he's now the king, is he now also the head of the Anglican Church? Puritan objections set forth in the Millenary Petition include, number one, the signing of the cross during baptism. So that would be, you know, the sign of the cross. Obviously, Catholic practice. Mm-hmm. Number two, confirmation. Number three, the administration of baptism by lay people. Number four, the use of rings in marriage ceremonies. The Puritans objected to that. Number five, bowing at the name of Jesus. Number six, requirement of the superfluous surplice and cap. Now, what that's talking about are the liturgical vestments, the robes and the hats and all the stuff that went with that. Okay, so that they're against that. The awarding of multiple ecclesiastical positions and receiving a pay for each. In addition, the Puritans disliked the terms priest and absolution, terms they perceived as Roman Catholic, wanted a stricter observance of the Sabbath, which was originally supported by James, up until the 1617 publication of the Book of Sports, which James also wrote, and claimed that ministers should be both able and, quote, able and sufficient men. So, those are the seven or eight things, most notable things that are their grievances against the church. All right? Things like the vestments, the sign of the cross, confirmation, the administration of baptism by lay people, the use of wedding rings, etc., right? Bowing at the name of Jesus. These are the things that are mentioned in the Millenary Petition that the Puritans wanted further reform with respect to. All right? Look at the next point. Timothy Berg maintains that the Millenary Petition was probably, quote, one of about half a dozen other petitions reportedly made to James while he was on his way to London from Edinburgh for his coronation between the 4th of April and the 7th of May, 1603. The petition was likely drafted by Arthur Hildersheim, at the behest of Stephen Edgerton, Though little else is known about the circumstances under which it was originally presented to King James. So, we know that it was written by Puritans. We know what their grievances were. We know it's presented to the king on his way down from Scotland between the 4th of April and the 7th of May in 1603. We think we might know who is primarily responsible for writing it, etc., but there's some other details about it that we just don't know, that aren't known to history. Now, you'll notice if you go back up to the previous point, what is conspicuously missing from the list? If you look at this list of seven things here at this point, what is not mentioned in the list? There's nothing said about a new what? A new translation. It's not even on their agenda, their list of things that they want the king to what? So how does this document then that's presented to the king become part of the story then that leads to the king's decision to make a new translation of the English Bible? Is everybody following what I'm saying? Okay? But it's not in the list. If you look at the next point. Conspicuously missing from the millenary petition is any language regarding a desire for a new translation of the Bible into English. Traditionally, the petition is viewed as the impetus for the Hampton Court Conference in January 1604. The meeting was originally set for November 1603, but had to be moved back on account of an outbreak of plague. And that is bubonic plague there, there was an outbreak of
COVID.
No. It was at this meeting that James made the decision to authorize a new translation of the Bible into English. Okay, so I'm just going to draw on the board here sort of the standard interpretation of this, right? The standard interpretation of this is the millenary petition is presented to James. And this is in spring 1603, right? James then is going to organize or call for a meeting at Hampton Court. And the original date for this meeting was November 1603, but it didn't happen because of an outbreak of plague. And so the meeting ultimately is going to happen in January 1604, all right? And then it's at this meeting that the decision is made to translate what? The King James Bible, right? So what we're talking about today, the millenary petition, is a historical event that is in this stream that ultimately results in what? In the decision to translate the King James Bible at Hampton Court in 1604. So most observers of history have said that it's this document, the millenary petition, that leads James to call that meeting. And it's at that meeting that the decision is made to do what? Translate this. To redo another English Bible. Okay? So, but my point to you right now is, does this say anything about a new Bible?
No.
It says nothing about a new Bible in the millenary petition. Okay? So I'll pause there for a minute. Does anybody have any questions? No? Okay. So, as it says there on that point right here, it was at this meeting that James made the decision to authorize a new translation of the English Bible. Now, let's look at the next point. Regarding the connection between the petition and the Hampton Court Conference, Timothy Burke states the following, quote, "The various requests made in the petition provide a window into the past, a snapshot frozen in time of the tensions and uncertainties, hopes and fears that were present when James I took the throne in 1603. They thus form essential background to the Hampton Court Conference, where these hopes would rise to their highest point before James largely dashed." That's his sentence, not mine. So in other words, I just copied it the way he wrote it. So if there's a strangeness to the sentence, it's not because of me, it's the way that it was originally wrote. So I put it in there exactly. But what he's saying is, so think about what he's saying. He's saying that the millenary petition leads to what? Hampton Court. So the high water mark for these Puritan grievances is they're going to be heard where? at Hampton Court, right? So at this meeting, the king is going to entertain or allow the Puritans an opportunity to present to them formally their grievances. Now, we're not there yet, but what Berg is saying is that essentially James is going to take their grievances and get a stick and just beat them into the ground, and he's basically going to give them nothing that they want. I'm jumping ahead in the story there a little bit, but they're basically not going to get very much that they want at that meeting. James is going to side more with the high bishops of the Anglican Church than he is going to with the Puritans. So, the millenary petition leads to Hampton Court. It's a hammer mark for these Puritan grievances. The king is basically going to shut them down. Now think about what happens in history after that. Is that going to prompt a lot of these Puritans to leave England and go first to the continent? And when it doesn't work out for them on the continent, they're going to go where? To North America. Okay? So this meeting is a very consequential meeting for a lot of reasons related to not only English religious history and politics, but to American history and what? Politics, right? In history, things have these unintended consequences that end up transpiring in ways that you can't see when their precursors occurred, if I could say it that way, right? So the petition is going to be instrumental in that. Now, there is some debate, though, about whether James would have wanted this meeting regardless of whether or not there had been one, a petition. So let's look at the next point. In a separate blog from June 1st, 2020, titled The Creation and Impact of the Millenary Petition, author Timothy Berg presents some recent research questioning the commonly accepted view that the millenary petition was the immediate impetus or cause for the Hampton Court Conference. In 2008, William Leonard Craig wrote an essay titled Hampton Court Again, The Millenary Petition and the Calling of the Conference that advances this argument. Citing Berg, quote, he, referring to Craig, suggests that James actually called the conference of his own accord, that it was not a response to the millenary petition, and that it was not so much an attempt to hear Puritan complaints as it was an attempt to ensure that Puritans would stay under his thumb. So this is an interesting thesis, okay? What this thesis is saying is that this millenary petition was not the immediate cause for the Hampton Court meeting. That James would have called a meeting such similar to this regardless of whether or not there had been one, a petition, because James had it in his mind already that he was not going to allow these squirrely Puritans to pull any fast ones on him and get him to do something that he didn't want to do. You guys following that? Now let's just back up from that for a minute and think about what we learned last time about James. It's my personal belief that Berg is quoting from Craig, William Leonard Craig, in his essay, Hampton Court Again. It's my opinion that what these two guys are suggesting is highly probable. James rules by divine right. We've established that by looking at his true law, the true law, free monarchies, and Baskill Adorn, right? So the idea that he's not going to allow these Puritans to, you know, connive and, you know, get him to do something that he doesn't really want to do, I think is not only plausible, I think it's probably very likely. Okay? You guys follow what I'm saying? On page 48 of his essay, Craig states the following, quote, it is all very well to say that it is, quote, it is well known that the Hampton Court Conference resulted from King James's favorable response to the millenary petition's request for a conference. But if this knowledge has no contemporary evidence to support it, then historians must read the evidence again. Although we cannot know it beyond doubt, it seems likely that the conference was the king's own idea. So in other words, unless there's a document or something that suggests that James is calling the Hampton Court meeting specifically because of the Puritan request, He's saying it's probably more likely that James is doing it because that's what James wanted to what? To do. Okay? Now, let's go on. Berg does an excellent job summarizing Craig's main arguments in support of his theory that James called the meeting independently of the millenary petition. The following summary of Craig's argument is quoted from Berg's blog entry. Quote, first, the king already had a well-established track record in Scotland of calling such conferences when he saw issues that needed handling with a royal touch. So let's stop right there. Has he already been king of Scotland for a long time? Has he called similar meetings in the Scottish Kirk and the Scottish Church of which he was the head? So, James has a history of having done this prior to 1603 when he was still only king of where? Scotland. And that topic there, that point, is going to come up big time later on. Because as it turns out, James, while he was still king of Scotland and was presiding over the Scottish Church, the Scottish Kirk, he had already decided that there needed to be a new Bible in English. So when these Puritans mention it for the first time in January 1604, they're not bringing up a topic that James hasn't already thought. Now, I'm getting way ahead of where we need to be, but I'm just saying that what is being brought to the fore here by Berg's blog and citing of Craig's essay has a lot of merit to me, and I kind of had the benefit of knowing what's coming next. You guys don't at this time, but I'm saying that there's a lot of validity, I feel, to what these two guys are saying, okay? So, look at the quote. First, the king already had a well-established track record in Scotland of calling such conferences when he saw issues that needed handling with a royal touch. This was his regular MO, or modus operandi, and he needed no outside impetus to prompt such an action. Indeed, he called three of them in 1604 alone. So, the king the way he's acting here is not abnormal for the way he's already acted and behaved as a king before he's king of England. You guys following that? Second, the language of the petition that has been cited as requesting the conference, quote, if it shall please your highness further to hear us, or more at large by writing to be informed, or by conference among the learned to be resolved, is exceptionally vague. Conference is only one of three different proposals, and in any case, quote, in the early 17th century, conference could mean anything from a simple conversation to a formal meeting between representatives of the two houses of parliament. So, it's not necessarily mandating in the petition that this formal meeting be held, okay? And there could have been other ways for dealing with it as they acknowledge in the specific language of the petition. Third, the surviving invitation of participants to the conference makes no mention of being a response to any petition. So there are some surviving documents of the king's invitation to whoever he wanted to invite to the meeting. When we look at those invitations, they say nothing about what? They say nothing about the millenary petition. Okay? It seems to assert rather that the conference was at the king's own wish, quote. It does not refer to the millenary petition, but says that the king wished to confer and advise with some of the bishops and other of the clergy of this realm of some matters of importance concerning ecclesiastical causes, end quote. So the king, in inviting people to the meeting, he doesn't say, I'm inviting you because I was asked to. He says, he doesn't even mention the millenary petition. He says, we need to have this meeting and I'm going to invite who I want to invite. I'm the king, I can do what I want. You guys following that? Okay. Fourth, and perhaps more important, as Craig demonstrates, no contemporary accounts. So that would have been accounts back here from 1603, 1604, from the early 17th century. No contemporary accounts link the petition and the conference. A connection only made by later historians. No mention is made of the petition in the official archives, not even in contemporary histories as related to the conference. No mention is made of it in the official account of the ascension. Despite its narrating some five petitions made during the journey of James to London. In fact, even in later accounts, the given date and location of the presentation of the position is amazingly inconsistent and unsettled. Not what one would expect from a petition so impactful as to have moved the king to call a major royal conference to resolve it. Okay?
So in that account where he's moving from Scotland to London, he was reading petitions, or how were five presented to him on that trip?
I think you came slightly late, but I mentioned that this millenary petition was one of many things that were presented to the king on his way from Edinburgh to London, and they're not all about religion or the church. Some of them are about other stuff, you know, economics or, you know, something with the government or whatever, but then some of them were related to theology or ecclesiastical things.
But were they just letters that
he was Yeah, they're just written things, and the king can do what he wants to with them, obviously. Top page 5. Fifth, the conference itself doesn't appear at all by its format to have been intended as a means to hear Puritan complaints. So the way the conference is structured does not appear that the main point of the conference is to let these Puritans tell the king what they think should happen. You following that? Mm-hmm. Almost 20 some odd avant-garde conformists, to use another historian's term, were present, while only four Puritan delegates were present. So there's 20 Anglican bishops and 4 Puritans at the Hampton Court meeting. Does that sound to you like the deck is stacked to one side over the other? Okay. Where are we at? We're present, while only 4 Puritan delegates were present, and these 4 were only allowed at one day of the conference. The conference is like a 3-day thing, 2 or 3-day thing. I'm confusing possibly 2 different conferences. There's 20 high Anglican bishops, 4 Puritans, and the Puritans are only allowed to stand before the king one time. Okay? So when you start doing the math on this, it starts stacking up like the king does not really give 2 hoots about what these Puritans think. You guys following that? Okay. What sentence are we on here? We're present, while only 4 Puritan delegates were, and these 4 were only allowed at one day of the conference, the king hearing from bishops and making decisions entirely without the rest of the conference. As had been noted before, quote, the conference made it perfectly clear that James was on the side of the establishment and expected all others to conform, crying out that if they failed to do so, quote, I will harry them out of the land or else do worse, right? So now you understand why these Puritans wanted to leave England and go somewhere else. Because by and large, are they almost completely shut down by King James? The king favored the religious establishment of the Anglican Church. The structure of the meeting says that. The way the meeting was conducted says that. Who's allowed to attend the meeting says that. The time they have in front of the king says that. You guys with that? Mm-hmm. Last, Craig concludes that, quote, the simplest reading of the evidence is that James called the conference at Hampton Court because that was his usual method of dealing with difficult questions in church and state, and not because he was asked to do it. He may be slightly overpressing his point in his attempt to reevaluate the Hampton Court Conference itself, but he at the very least raises concerns about connecting the conference and the petition too strongly, and gives clear reason to question the role of the petition as the solitary cause of the conference. So, here's what I think. Do I think this was a factor? Do I think the millenary petition was a factor in calling the Hampton Court Conference? Yes, I think it was a factor. Is it the only factor or even the most important factor? I would say no. I would say the most overruling important factor is the political belief and psychological makeup of the king and how he viewed authority in his realm and how he viewed the Puritans. Which is why I spent a whole lesson telling you about all that last time in lesson 152. Because all of that is all coming together in what's happening and why it's happening. Craig's thesis, as attractive as I find it, given our background study of King James, has had difficulty dislodging the commonly held assumption that the petition was the immediate impetus for the Hampton Court Conference. One reason for this might be that William Barlow, the author of Sum and Substance, the semi-official record of the proceeding, I should say the proceedings, at Hampton Court, mentions the petition in several places. Okay, so let's stop there. The biggest... Barlow takes notes on what happened at Hampton Court, and in his notes he mentions the petition. Okay? So, those who view the Millenary Petition as the immediate cause and impetus of the Hampton Court Conference will point to the notes of Barlow from this meeting. Okay? However, there's nothing else to go on, and when you look at, as I've said, the points that Craig raises, I think there's strong reason to say that James would have done this probably regardless of whether or not there had ever been a petition. You guys following that? Timothy Burke provides the following analysis. Quote, he describes the four Puritan representatives, Reynolds, Sparks, Newstubbs, and Chatterton, for example, as, quote, agents of the Millenary plaintiffs. It's from Barlow, page 2. He also describes how while Reynolds was making his case to the king, Richard Bancroft, Bishop of London, and the arch-anti-Puritan, and shortly thereafter Archbishop of Canterbury, and the major architect of the King James Bible, rudely interrupted him, and knelt down before the king dramatically begging that no more should be heard from these schismatics. He presented three reasons why. His second reason was, quote, that if any of these parties were in the number of the 1,000 ministers who had once subscribed to the Book of Common Prayer and yet had lately exhibited a petition to His Majesty against it, that they might be removed and not heard according to the decree of the very ancient council providing, quote, that no man should be admitted to speak against that whereunto he hath formerly subscribed. So Bancroft's trying to shut them down and say, you shouldn't even allow these guys to speak because in signing the Millenary Petition and agreeing to its grievances, they're backing out of something that they already said they what? Would do or believed. Okay. Regarding what this might mean for the veracity of Craig's thesis, Berg states the following quote. This argues that the impact of the petition was clearly felt at the conference. Yet, it also further supports Craig's claims. If the conference had been called to hear the complaints of the petition, it would hardly make sense to ban anyone from speaking who had signed it. Think about what Bancroft's asking the king to do. He's asking the king to ban anyone who signed the petition from talking at the conference. Well, if the conference had been called to hear the complaints of these guys, why even bother having one? The conference, if the king didn't already want to have say at such a meeting independent of the petition. You guys following that? Okay. As Craig notes on the very bottom of page 5, these references which seem to refer to the humble petition show that Barlow and Bancroft considered it the centerpiece of Puritan agitation, but not that they thought the conference had been called as a response to it. Craig's argument does not so much sever the connection between the petition and the conference as weaken it, or more specifically, remove its causal elements, urging us to speak in more nuanced ways of the connections. The petition was still, quote, the centerpiece of Puritan agitation, which was put on dramatic display at the conference. So, just think about what's going on here. Does it make sense to you that Queen Elizabeth has been ruling and governing in a particular way, following this middle path now for like 50 years. The Puritans did not like what she was doing. They thought her reforms had not gone far enough. So now, the new king is coming down, and it makes sense that they see this as an opportunity to press their case for further reform, right? But the king has not operated in a vacuum. And he already has expressed in writing his personal views about governance and politics and divine right of kings and what the role of the monarch was, and so on and so forth, right? And does he already have strongly formulated opinions as he's moving down to England that he doesn't care two hoots at all what these Puritans think? But it further makes sense, at least to me then, that some type of meeting like this was going to be inevitable, whether this type of a petition had ever been written or not. So, there's a connection. It's unavoidable. Although I tend to agree with Craig's thesis that I think James would have done this regardless of whether or not the petition had ever been written. Because I think that's who James was, and I think that's how James dealt with things. Because he'd already done it that way in Scotland for a long time before he became King of England. So let's finish these notes and we'll take any questions. For our purposes, it's important to remember that the petition makes no mention of a Puritan desire for a new Bible translation. Evidence that we will consider in future lessons suggests, that in 1603, as he made his way from Scotland to England, it was only James himself who thought there needed to be a new translation of the Bible into English. Think about it. What Bible are the Puritans using? What Bible are the Puritans using? Anybody remember? Good thing it's not a test. They're using the Geneva.
Oh, man.
What Bible are the Anglican bishops using?
Bishops.
The Bishop's Bible. Okay? Somebody got something right. Okay. They're using the Bishop's Bible. Do these guys think they need a new Bible? No. They're perfectly content to use the Bible made by their own bishops. Do the Puritans think they need a new Bible? No, because they're perfectly content to use what?
Geneva.
The Geneva Bible. Who hates the Geneva Bible?
James.
Why does James hate the Geneva Bible? Because the Geneva Bible contains marginal notes that undermine divine right of kings. The most popular Bible among the people was the Geneva. The Bible read in the Anglican service was what? The bishops. So what is the King James going to be?
Replacement for
the King James is going to be, guess what? The middle way. That's what it's going to be. It's a political move, folks. On the part of James, it's a political move. It's not even mentioned where. It's not even mentioned in the petition. Why? Because are they perfectly fine with the Geneva? In fact, I'm going to show you that when Reynolds, the chief Puritan speaker at Hampton Court, finally says something about it, he corrects the bishops with the Geneva, clearly showing that what he really wanted was not a new Bible. He wanted the king to sanction what?
The Geneva.
But James enters into this thing, and has he already thought about this? You guys with me? Okay, I'm getting a little bit ahead of the story a little bit, but I want you to see where this is going and why everything we're talking about right now is important, right? When he becomes the king, there is a political division in his country between the Puritans who read the Geneva and the Anglicans who read what? The bishops. So here's what he's going to do. He's going to sanction this. But he's going to say you need to use that as the base text. So does he get And he's going to say, you got. Not only is he going to say you got to use that as the base text, but he's going to say no marginal what? Notes. So is he ultimately going to get what he wants politically based upon the people he favors and their Bible as the base for what this is going to be without the notes of what? Of that. Now look. So you can view this from two sides. Okay? And I feel what has happened far too often in the whole Bible version debate and discussion is people tend to favor looking at pro-King James advocates tend to look at this all as, you know, the divine work of God. Pulling James's strings and doing this and doing that and, you know, all the result of this divine intervention stuff. You could look at it that way, and that's how most people have looked at it. But what I'm suggesting to you is that if you want to understand it, you have to look at it the way I'm explaining it to you. Now, is God involved in some way when men sit down to translate His Word? They have the Word of God, and if these are truly saved men, is the Spirit in them? But God's not going to inspire them newly or freshly in any way, right? They are translating what's already there into a new what? Into a new language, okay? But all this stuff here is the nuts and bolts of what occurred. All right, so did I finish the reading here, or did I get into that too soon? Did I finish the notes? Did I read the last point? Did I read the quote?
No.
Oh, I got off on that too soon. Sorry about that. So for our purposes, it's important to remember that the petition makes no mention of a Puritan desire for a new Bible translation. Evidence that we will consider in future lessons suggests that in 1603, as he made his way from Scotland to England, it was only James himself who thought there needed to be a new translation of the Bible into English. So that's what I was talking about, and that's how I got off on this, right? The Anglicans are using the Bishop's Bible, and they're perfectly good with that. The Puritans are using what? The Geneva Bible, and are they perfectly good with that? In this whole meeting, when it starts, who's the only one in the whole meeting that already thinks there needs to be a new Bible? James. And I'll prove it to you in a later lesson. Okay? Let me read the quote. It remains an important window, talking about the millenary petition, it remains an important window into the exploding controversy between nonconformists and the avant-garde conformists that was first publicly showcased at the conference, which conceived the King James Bible, partly as an ultimately failed attempt to bring uniformity to the controversy. Though it's important to remember that the petition itself makes no mention of a new translation, which was probably at that point only desired by the king himself, being little more than a gleam in the Puritan eye. In the next lesson, we will begin our consideration of the Hampton Court Conference. Okay? So, we do have a few minutes for questions if anybody wants to raise anything. Look, guys, let me say, I'm not saying that God was uninvolved in the process. But what I am saying is that I'm not willing to view the King James Bible as a re-inspiration of the Bible into English, and that if you're going to really understand how it came to be, you have to understand it based upon the factors that are understandable and take the hocus pocus and the mysticism out of it. Okay? Now, some people are going to watch this video and hear me say that, and they're going to comment bomb the comments about how terrible of a statement that is. What I'm saying to you, though, is those are the historical facts of what happened and why. So, the Millenary Petition has nothing in it about a new Bible. There's a loose connection between the petition and Hampton Court. James's decision to call Hampton Court, I believe, would have happened regardless if there had ever been a petition. And it's at this meeting in January 1604 that the first mention of a new Bible is even made. And as soon as it's made, James jumps all over it. Now you have to say, well, why would he do that if he hadn't already what? Thought about it. Well, I'll talk to you more about that in a future lesson. All right, anybody got any questions?
Could you make a pie chart as to the percentage of who was what at that time, of how many, this percentage was Puritan, this percentage was like Roman Catholic, this percentage was, you know that?
I could try to find, I mean, I'm sure you could in estimated form. I don't think it would be like accurate to the number, but maybe I'll look around and see if I can find something like that.
As far as the pie would go, the Puritan would be a pretty small piece. They weren't real big.
It's hard to say because the people in their homes were reading this.
Now, the Geneva Bible, because you keep saying everything's going to be an English Bible. So if this is a Geneva Bible, it's not English that we're reading?
No, it's English. The Geneva Bible's English.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you mean when you kept saying it's going to be a new English?
Both of these are English Bibles.
Okay.
As Berg puts it, the avant-garde conformists, the Anglican bishops, have their Bible that they made, called the Bishop's Bible. The Puritans have their Bible, the Geneva Bible, which was made by Genevan exiles during the reign of Bloody Mary. And this is the more popular Bible read by people in their homes. This is the Bible that they're using in Anglican church meetings. So, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about there's a split amongst the English-speaking people of the day over what Bible they're going to use. And then James enters into this, and this is a political divide because now we're having a church meeting basically presided over by the King of England to decide. So, I don't know if I'm answering your question. I hope I am.
Well, you have King James Bible.
Mm-hmm.
When you read out of your Bible, because this is a new King James Bible, and they're not the same. So is it kind of like the difference between the Geneva and the Bishop's Bibles? You're reading, but there's little differences here and there.
I would say, on the surface, yes, that is a fair, just general comparison. I'm not convinced personally that there aren't substantive differences in meaning between the King James and the New King James. But as a generic way of comparing it, yes, these are both English Bibles. They, in 90% of, they're probably going to read similarly. They're all in the line of William Tyndale. But then there are certain parts that are definitely translated, particularly by the bishops, using more liturgical language and words than were used in the Geneva Bible, and it was done that way on purpose. And if you're interested in hearing about that, in previous lessons, there's a whole section on all of that where I talk about all that. But they're both English Bibles.
Okay.
Now, what makes a King James different from an NIV, for example, is the text basis. What Greek text is being used to make that translation? So when the NIV leaves out verses or changes whole phrases or what have you, the reason they're doing that is because their underlying Greek text is not the same as the underlying Greek text supporting the King James Bible. Now that's, in a nutshell, in 5 minutes, as simply as I could state that. When you get into the Bible version debate, yes, it's related to translation, but it's also related to text. What text is being translated? The Geneva and the Bishop's Bible have the same text basis. They're coming from the same text basis, and both of them are fundamentally revisions of William Tyndale. Okay? What's happening with modern versions is very different, because in the 1800s, the text basis of the English Reformation was switched for a so-called new and improved Greek text. that varies from the text of the Reformation in thousands of places, some of which are substantive. Does that make sense? So that's about as simply as I could say it in a nutshell, I guess. We could talk more if you want. Yeah.
To better understand these conferences, I'm thinking of movies I've seen, but are they, there's like 20 people that support one, and then there's four of
the other side.
Puritans. And then they're only allowed, the Puritans, one day of a 3-day conference, so it's not like a court before a king, or what is this court?
No, it's okay. Not a court like a court of law, mm-hmm. but it's in the king's court. The king is seated on his throne presiding over the meeting.
Right.
And you've got, on one side of the room, you've got your Anglican bishops, and on the other side of the room, you've got your four Puritans. There's 20 of them and four Puritans
yeah.
in this chamber before the king.
But are they just brought before the king to present their... Why would the Puritans only be allowed one day? Is what
because, Bart, the king can do what he wants. And if he only wants to...
I'm just trying to picture the setting and how the interaction... Did anybody... discuss things with the king, or
oh, yeah.
are they just presenting their opinions and then king's making a ruling, or how does that work?
I would say whatever, I would say an image that you have in your head from a movie set in the 16, 1700s of a king hearing opposing sides of a matter and then having the sole authority to decide what happens.
Yeah.
That's probably, in a general sense, a fairly good mental image to have of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the particulars and the ins and outs of it, not sure. What I do know, though, is that there was confusion about what day the meeting started. The 20 Anglican bishops show up, and the king is like, and I'm, you know, sort of playing around here, but, and the king isn't like, wait, time out. You guys are here early and the other guys aren't here yet. We need to wait to make this fair. Oh no. Come on in. Let's talk. And so they have a whole day of private meetings with the king before the meeting even officially starts. So the king is obviously 100% favorable to who? These guys.
Okay. I mean, that's one. I mean, you're just guessing at that, or?
I'm not guessing at who he favors.
No. I mean, you're just guessing at why the Puritans were only allowed one day, as opposed.
No, it's a proven fact that there was confusion over what day the meeting started.
Okay.
I'll get into that next time.
Okay.
But just a reminder: next week, we will have a 9 o'clock study, but it will be part of the Bible conference, so we will not be having this class. This class will resume. I think it's October 31st on Halloween. And we will continue this conversation then. I'm going to have to turn all the stuff off and pack up. Thank you for those of you that joined us here on the live stream.